Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Eastern Airlines Radio Show. Breaking news.
Breaking news number one. Low-cost Surefly Octocopter. It's a personal helicopter. At the Paris Show in 2017, was shown. That's by A.V. Webb. Ohio-based Workhorse Group, which builds hybrid electric trucks for UPS, FedEx, and others, thinks it's time to rethink the design characteristics of the traditional helicopter. The first stab at it is Surefly VTOL aircraft. It attracted huge attention at the Innovation Center at AirVenture Oshkosh past summer. Aviation consumer editor Larry Angelisano took a close look and prepared this product video. 200,000 in 2 years out from production. $1,000 deposit down is all you need. Taking orders on their website. It has manual flight mode. You just grab the joystick. You have autonomous mode with a GPS to talk to satellites. It will fly by the end of the year. And foldable arms so you can garage it. 2-liter four-cylinder gas engine. See more in newsletter online August, December 2017.
Breaking news number two. The Department of Homeland Security, DHS, hacked airliner systems. By Russ Niles, November 13, 2017. The Department of Homeland Security has reportedly told a cybersecurity conference it was able to hack the internal systems of a Boeing 757 sitting on the ramp at Atlantic City Airport with no help from anyone on board or anywhere near the aircraft. DHS cybersecurity expert Robert Hickey is quoted by Avionics Today as saying, quote, "We got the airplane on September 19, 2016, and 2 days later, I was successful in accomplishing a remote, non-cooperative penetration, which means I didn't have anybody touching the airplane, I didn't have an insider threat, I stood off using typical stuff that could get through security, and we were able to establish a presence on the systems of the aircraft," unquote. Hickey was speaking at the CyberSat Summit in Virginia, November 8th. See more in newsletter online, August to December 17th.
Breaking news number three. Bird slams into a Miami-bound flight. Bird was the only casualty. By Howard Cohen, Miami Herald, Miami Tribune. An American Airlines Airbus A319 bound for Miami from Mexico City was slammed in the nose by a bird. As Flight 1498 approached Miami International Airport at around 11 a.m. Tuesday, the large bird hit the front end of the plane and became embedded in the nose, WPLG Local Channel 10 reported. Bird crashes into plane often. The FAA reported more than 160,000 bird strikes in a 25-year period from 1990 to 2015. Sometimes the results are deadly, and not just for the feathered victims. You can see more of this in the newsletter August through December 17th. Chuck.
Breaking news number four. Transport Canada reinforces pot ban by Russ Niles. Transport Canada is reminding pilots that while the rest of the country may be changing its attitude towards marijuana, it hasn't relaxed its stance. On July 1st, 2018, possession of a small amount of pot and its recreational use will be legal in Canada. Provinces are developing intoxication detection and enforcement standards for drivers caught impaired behind the wheel. TC officials told delegates at the Air Transport Association of Canada meeting last week that any amount of TCH, the psychoactive chemical in cannabis, found in a pilot's bloodstream will result in the immediate suspension of flight privileges and will last until the TCH is flushed from his or her system. See more in newsletter online August, December 17th.
Jim Hart, if you're with us, it's all yours. Hello, Eastern family. It's great having you with us for our 342nd broadcast tonight. We want to welcome and thank all of our listeners who called into our broadcast to listen. We would love to hear your comments or have you share your memories by just calling us and saying hello and talk to us while we're on the air live. Our thanks also to those who chose to listen by computer using the radio icon on our homepage at www.ealradioshow.com, or perhaps by using your computer, just signing in at the site of our provider, Blog Talk Radio, at www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. That's CaptainEddie. Should you too wish to talk on our live broadcast, feel free to use our call-in number, 213-816-1611 at 7 p.m. and join us. Our lines are open after our program, and if you choose not to participate and talk, we ask you please mute your telephone, your phone, as our board, our producer board, does not have the capability of filtering out background noises. Now, let's get the episode 342 in the air.
Bill.
Okay, Bill Joseph, sorry I didn't turn your microphone on, but you're on now.
Well, I wonder if our listeners remember 46 years ago, this coming Friday, November the 24th, one of the greatest mysteries in aviation occurred, and that's our story for tonight.
Hey, guys, I'll get the weather and sign the dispatch release. You guys go on out to the aircraft and do a pre-flight. Looks like we're going to be rainy all day out there at the Great Pacific Northwest. So what else is new?
A gentleman in his mid-40s wearing a suit, black trench coat, and loafers walks up to the Northwest Airlines ticket counter at the Portland International Airport. He's carrying a black attaché case.
And good morning, sir. How may I help you?
I'd like to purchase a one-way ticket to Seattle.
Certainly, sir. May I have your name, please?
Yes, Dan Cooper. And how much is the fare?
Would you like first class or coach?
Coach will be fine.
Okay, that comes to $18.97. Now, do you have any luggage you would like to check, Mr. Cooper?
Here I have cash, $20. Just keep the change. Nope. I'm just carrying my attaché case with me.
Here's your change. Your ticket's coming through right now. Let's see. Looks like you'll be in row 18C. That's 18C. Here you go. You have a nice flight, Mr. Cooper. Oh, you'll be boarding through gate 7B, just right down there.
Mr. Dan Cooper thanks the agent and starts out to the gate for boarding flight 305. At 2:15 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. He appears to be a businessman wearing a dark suit, neatly pressed white shirt with a black tie and a mother-of-pearl tie pin. His black trench coat is now over his left arm with the attaché case carried in his right hand. Just another male passenger en route to Seattle for a business meeting.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're ready for boarding flight 305 for Seattle, Washington. Please present your tickets to the agent at the door. You have a nice trip. Thank you for flying with Northwest Orient Airlines. Oh, hello, Mr. Cooper. I work the boarding, as you can see, as well as the check-in. Now, you enjoy your flight, sir. Good afternoon. I see you're in seat 18C, sir. You can store your attaché case and your overcoat in the overhead compartment if you like.
Well, I'll keep both of them with me unless there's somebody occupying the seats next to me. Thank you very much, miss.
36 additional passengers board the plane. The flight attendants prepare the cabin for departure. The main boarding door is closed, and Flight 305 taxis away from the gate at approximately 2:40 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. The flight attendants go through the cabin taking drink orders.
Excuse me, sir. Would you like a beverage after takeoff? This is only a 30-minute flight. We try to get all our beverages served shortly after takeoff.
Well, thank you. Yes, I would. I'll have a bourbon and soda, please. And may I smoke?
No, sir. Not until we are in the air and the captain has turned off the no-smoking sign.
Captain William Scott, First Officer William Ratasek, and Second Officer H.E. Anderson are cleared to runway 28 right by the Portland Control Tower. In the cabin, Senior Flight Attendant Alice Hancock, Florence Schaffner, Tina Mucklow buckle themselves into their assigned jump seats for departure. Florence Schaffner takes the aft jump seat at the rear aft stairs exit.
Okay, we've got the checklist done, Bill. Tell the tower we're ready for takeoff.
Sure, Captain. Portland Northwest 305 is ready for takeoff.
Roger, Northwest 305, you're cleared for takeoff. The wind is 260 degrees at 6 knots. Fly runway heading and contact departure on 120.5 when airborne. Have a good day.
Roger. Clear for takeoff. Maintain runway heading and departure 120.5.
Bill, why don't you take us to Portland, and I'll fly the next leg.
The Boeing 727-100 is in position on the runway, and the first officer smoothly advances the three thrust levers to take off power. As the aircraft accelerates, the captain calls out the V1, VR, and V2 speeds as the aircraft lifts off the runway and starts its initial climb to 3,000 feet on runway heading. Meanwhile, back in the cabin, an interesting event is about to take place.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned off the no smoking sign, and for those who wish to smoke, smoking is allowed only at your seats. The lavatories, aisles, and alleys, galleys are no smoking areas. Your flight attendants will be coming through the cabin with your drink orders momentarily. The fasten seatbelt sign will remain illuminated throughout the flight, since this is only a 30-minute flight.
Here you are, sir. I hope you don't mind Jack Daniel's soda. Excuse me, sir, you dropped this piece of paper.
Yes, you better take a look at that note.
Thinking that the note was from another male passenger making a pass at her, goes to her seat and looks at the note. It says, "I have a bomb in my briefcase. I will use it if necessary. I want you to sit next to me. You are being hijacked. Now do exactly as I say, and no one will be harmed."
Sir, may I see what you say? The bomb?
Cooper opens the attaché, and the flight attendant catches a glimpse at what appears to be a mass of wires and red-colored sticks, and demanded that she write down what he told her. Soon she was walking in oats up to the captain of the plane that demanded four parachutes and $200,000 in $20 bills.
Captain, we have a very serious problem. A passenger showed me a bomb in a briefcase and gave me this note to bring to you.
Let me see the note, please. I demand $200,000 in negotiable American currency and four parachutes. In return, I will allow 36 people to leave the aircraft when the plane lands in Seattle. The amount will be in $20 bills placed in small packages. I want a fuel truck waiting to refuel the airplane. Parachutes should be two primary and two reserve chutes. Florence, what is his demeanor? Is he unruly in the cabin or causing any disturbance among the passengers?
No, to the contrary, Captain. He is a quiet man who appears to be in his mid-40s. He's wearing a business suit with a black tie and a white shirt. He ordered a drink, bourbon and soda, while the flight was waiting to take off. He is not causing any disturbance among the passengers. I suspect no one knows about his demand so far.
Well, good. Let's try to keep it that way. Since he hasn't demanded entrance to the flight deck, we'll try to keep that way so he can't come in either. Advise him that we will forward his request to the company in Seattle and try to have his demands met when we arrive. Let's work first on getting the passengers off the aircraft safely when we arrive, and then we will determine what his plans are after he receives the items he has requested. Go back and try to assure him that we will meet his demands as stated.
Flight attendant Florence Schaffner calmly leaves the flight deck and takes a seat next to Cooper. Cooper is looking out the window as the aircraft passes over the Tacoma area and comments to Schaffner.
It looks like we're passing over Tacoma down there. I believe that's McCord Air Force Base, and it's only a 20-minute drive to SeaTac, Seattle-Tacoma Airport. I sure would like to have another Jack Daniels and soda. And please let me know what I owe for my drinks. Also, When you go back up to the flight deck, tell the pilot to order meals for 6 crew members when we leave Seattle.
I'll get this to the captain right away and be back to let you know what the captain will do.
Once again, Flight Attendant Schaffner returns to the flight deck and delivers Cooper's latest demands.
Captain, this man doesn't fit the profile of a hijacker. He is calm, he's a person, and even showed knowledge of where we were when we passed over Tacoma. He mentioned that McCord Air Base was only about 20 miles away from Tacoma. He's wearing a pair of sunglasses now. Seems to be enjoying the flight and even tried to tip me after paying for the drink. But his bum sure looks like the real thing when we opened that attachment gate.
You're doing just great, Florence. Bill, you fly the aircraft, and I'll take care of the emergency hijacking code for the transponder and talk to the company. Seattle Approach, this is Northwest 305. We are at our assigned altitude of 15,000 and on the airway about 60 miles out. We're squawking 76 on the transponder, and I'm sure you've picked us up by now. We need to leave the frequency to go over to our company for further instructions, and we'll need an assigned location to hold our present altitude.
Roger that, Northwest 305. Let us know if you need any special assistance when you land. Proceed on your present inbound heading to the airport and hold at Puget, 15-mile DME fix. We'll listen in on your company frequency as well. And good luck.
Seattle Operations, this is Flight 305. Make sure you got something to write with. We got a very special request from a person that doesn't want no for an answer.
We're ready, Captain.
We're ready.
We were advised by air traffic control that you were on the emergency code. Let us know what we need to do and the demands that's being made.
Well, first off, we got a very calm and deliberate hijacker on board. Not your average variety. The flight attendants are doing an excellent job to this point. Now, here's what he's asking for. $200,000 in U.S. dollars and $20 denominations placed in several packages. He wants 4 parachutes, 2 primary, and 2 reserve packs. Have the fuel truck standing by for refueling. I'll let you know how much when we're on the ground. And oh yes, he wants 6 meals delivered to the aircraft with the items I just mentioned and start AAP. We will be holding pattern over the Puget Sound area. I'll make an announcement to the passengers that we're experiencing a mechanical problem or to avoid that the hijacking is in progress on the airplane.
We have all that copied, Captain, and we have the company president, Donald Nyrop, on the line now. I'll get back with you when it has been determined if all the requests can be met and how soon it will be.
I'm counting on all the requests to be met and quickly. I'll be here with the frequency open unless you want me on another for security purposes. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Captain Scott. We have a small malfunction in one of our hydraulic systems. We'll be circling an area over Puget Sound until we can resolve this issue. We're talking with our maintenance tech support in Minneapolis and should have our problem corrected soon. Not to worry, folks. We've done backup systems and we shouldn't not have any problems landing. I will keep you informed as to our progress. Thank you for your patience.
The aircraft circled Puget Sound for approximately 2 hours to allow Seattle police and the FBI time to assemble Cooper's parachutes and ransom money and to mobilize emergency personnel. At 5:24 p.m., Cooper was informed that his demands had been met. And at 5:39 p.m., the aircraft landed at Seattle-Tacoma Airport. Cooper instructed Scott to taxi the jet to an isolated, brightly lit section of the tarmac and extinguish the lights in the cabin to deter police snipers. Northwest Orient's Seattle Operations Manager, Al Lee, approached the aircraft in street clothes to avoid the possibility that Cooper might mistake his airline uniform for that of a police officer, and delivered the cash-filled knapsack and parachutes to flight attendant Gina Mucklow via the aft stairs. Once the delivery was completed, Cooper permitted all passengers, Gaffner, and senior flight attendant Alice Hancock to leave the plane.
Here are your instructions, Captain, for both takeoff and when we are in the air. I want you to take a southeast heading toward Mexico City after takeoff at the minimum airspeed possible without stalling, and don't go any higher than 10,000 feet altitude. The landing gear is to remain deployed in the takeoff landing position, and the wing flaps should be lowered to 15 degrees, and the cabin has to remain unpressurized.
Approximately 1,000 miles under that condition. You know, under specified conditions of flight configuration, you're asking us to maintain, that's going to be almost impossible. We'll have to make a second refueling before entering Mexico. I think we ought to refuel in Reno, Nevada, if that's okay with you, sir.
Okay, all right. We'll refuel in Reno. And I also want you to take off with the rear door open and the aft air stairs deployed down.
Well, we're going to have to call our tech support to see what problems this will cause. It may be that we can't do this for safety and structural reasons. Anderson, give tech service a call and see if this is possible.
Yes, sir, right away.
Never mind. I'll just lower the stairs myself once we're in flight.
I've got the company representative on the ground connection and has an FAA official asking to come aboard to speak with you. They're also telling me that they have fuel vapor lock in the fueling truck pumping mechanism. They've gone after another fueling truck and they're loading the meals.
Absolutely no. That's no to the FAA coming aboard, but okay to get another fuel truck.
At approximately 7:40 p.m., the 727 took off with only Cooper, pilot Scott, flight attendant Mucklow, co-pilot Radzak, and flight engineer H.E. Anderson aboard. Two F-106 fighter aircraft scrambled from nearby McChord Air Base, followed behind the airliner, one above it and one below, out of Cooper's view. A Lockheed T-33 trainer diverted from an unrelated Air National Guard mission also shadowed the 727 until it ran low on fuel and turned back near the Oregon-California border.
Okay, now that we're back there, miss, I want you to go up, join the rest of the crew in the cockpit, and remain there with that cockpit door closed.
As she complied, Mucklow observed Cooper tying something around his waist. At approximately 8 p.m., a warning light flashed in the cockpit.
Hey, Captain, I got an aft air stair door light. Yep, I guess he's activated the lowering of the air test stairs. Oh, did you feel that? Cabin pressure change.
Yeah, I got a quick nose pitch change. I'm putting in some trim to regain level flight.
All right. Well, it looks like he's left the aircraft. He's going to get mighty wet. We're in a heavy rain cell that we've been flying through for several minutes now.
At that moment, the aircraft was flying through a heavy rainstorm over the Lewis River in southwestern Washington. He exited at 10,000 feet at about 180 knots with the 727's gear down and flaps at 15 degrees. Since skydivers of the day exited airplanes flying at half that speed, it was assumed by some, perhaps even the FBI, that the exit itself was unsurvivable. But this is in doubt. Some parachutists have exited a 727 at speeds up to 190 knots through airspeed. It's not necessarily pleasant at these speeds, but it's eminently survivable. At these speeds, the slipstream hits you like a hammer. but it's possible to remain relatively stable. If he was experienced in free fall, Cooper might have delayed his pull to bleed off the exit speed and deployed at terminal velocity. The NBA chute had no sleeve or deployment bag, so the opening shock would have been considerable, but hardly fatal. It would have knocked off his slip-on loafers.
Aboard the airliner, FBI agents recovered 66 unladen fingerprints. Cooper's black clip-on tie and mother-of-pearl tie clip, and two of the four parachutes, one of which has been opened and two shroud lines cut from its canopy. Eyewitnesses in Portland, Seattle, and Reno, all individuals who personally interacted with Cooper, were interviewed. A series of composite sketches was developed. Local police and FBI agents immediately began questioning possible suspects. One of the first was an Oregon man with a minor police record named D.B. Cooper. Contacted by the Portland police on the off chance that the hijacker had used his real name or the same alias in previous crimes. His involvement was quickly ruled out, but an inexperienced wireless service operator, reporter, Clyde Jobin of UPI by most accounts, Joe Fraser of AP by others, rushed to meet the imminent deadline, confused the immediate suspect's name with a pseudonym used by the hijacker. The mistake was picked up and repeated by numerous other media sources, and a moniker, D.B. Cooper, became lodged in the public's collective memory. Looping animation of the 727 rear air stairs deploying in flight, the gravity-operated apparatus remained open until the aircraft landed.
Precise search area was difficult to define, as even small differences in estimates of the aircraft speed or the environmental conditions along the flight path changed Cooper's projected landing point considerably. An important variable was the length of time he remained in free fall before pulling his ripcord, if indeed he succeeded in opening a parachute at all. Neither of the Air Force fighter pilots saw anything exit the airliner, either visually or on radar. Nor did they see a parachute open, but at night, with extremely limited visibility and cloud cover obscuring any ground lighting below, an airborne human figure clad entirely in black clothing could easily have gone undetected. The T-33 pilots never made visual contact with the 727 at all. An experimental recreation was conducted using the same aircraft hijacked by Cooper in the same flight configuration piloted by Scott. FBI agents pushing a 200-pound sled out of the open air stair were able to produce the upward motion of the tail section described by the flight crew at 8:13 p.m. Based on this experiment, it was concluded that 8:13 p.m. was the most likely jump time. At that moment, the aircraft was flying through a heavy rainstorm over the Lewis River in southwestern Washington.
Initial extrapolations placed Cooper's landing area on the southernmost outreach of Mount St. Helens, a few miles southeast of Ariel, Washington, near Lake Merwin, an artificial lake formed by a dam on the Lewis River. Search efforts focused on Clark and Cowlitz counties, encompassing the terrain immediately south and north, respectively, of the Lewis River in southwest Washington. FBI agents and sheriff's deputies from those counties searched large areas of the mountainous wilderness on foot and by helicopter. Door-to-door questioning and searches of local farmhouses were also carried out. Other search parties ran patrol boats along Lake Merwin and Yale Lake, the reservoir immediately to its east. No trace of Cooper, nor any of the equipment presumed to have left the aircraft with him, was found. The FBI also coordinated an aerial search using fixed-wing aircraft and helicopters from the Oregon Army National Guard. Along the entire flight path, known as Victor 23 in standard aviation terminology, but Vector 23 in most Cooper literature, from Seattle to Reno, while numerous broken treetops and several pieces of plastic and other objects that from the air resembled parachute canopies were sighted and investigated, nothing relevant to the hijacking was found.
In early 1972, shortly after the spring thaw, teams of FBI agents aided by some 200 Army soldiers from Fort Lewis, along with Air Force personnel, National Guard troops, and civilian volunteers, conducted another thorough ground search of Clark and Cowlitz counties for 18 days in March, and then an additional 18 days in April. Electronic Explorations Company, a marine salvage firm, used a submarine to search the 200-foot depths of Lake Murrin. Two local women stumbled upon the skeleton in an abandoned structure in Clark County. It was later identified as the remains of a female teenager who had been abducted and murdered several weeks before. Ultimately, the search operation, arguably the most extensive and intensive in U.S. history, uncovered no significant material evidence related to the hijacking. Subsequent analysis called the original landing zone estimate into question. Scott, who was flying the aircraft manually because of Cooper's speed and altitude demands, later determined that his flight path was significantly farther east than initially assumed. Additional data from a variety of sources, in particular Continental Airlines pilot Tim Bowen, who was flying 4 minutes behind the Flight 305, indicated that the wind direction factored into drop zone calculations had been wrong, possibly by as much as 80 degrees. This and other supplemental data suggested that the actual drop zone was probably south-southeast of the original estimate in the drainage area of the Washougal River. I have to confess, wrote retired FBI Chief Investigator Ralph Himmelbach in his 1986 book, if I were going to look for Cooper, I would head for the Washougal. The Washougal Valley and its surroundings have been searched by multiple private individuals and groups in subsequent years to date. Nothing directly traceable to the hijacking has been found.
In late 1971, the FBI distributed lists of the ransom serial numbers to financial institutions, casinos, racetracks, and other businesses routinely conducting significant cash transactions, and to law enforcement agencies around the world. Northwest Orient offered a reward of 15% of the recovered money to a maximum of $25,000. In early 1972, U.S. Attorney General John Mitchell released the serial numbers to the general public. In 1972, two men used counterfeit $20 bills printed with Cooper serial numbers to swindle $30,000 from a Newsweek reporter named Carl Fleming in exchange for an interview with a man they falsely claimed was the hijacker. In early 1973, with the ransom money still missing, the Portland, Oregon Journal republished the serial numbers and offered $1,000 to the first person to turn in a ransom bill to the newspaper or any FBI field office. In Seattle, the Post Intelligencer made a similar offer with a $5,000 reward. The offers remained in effect until Thanksgiving 1974, and while there were several near matches, no genuine bills were found. In 1975, Northwest Orient's insurer, Global Indemnity Company, complied with an order from the Minnesota Supreme Court and paid the airline's $180,000 claim on the ransom money.
Now, in 1976, discussion arose over impending expiration of the statute of limitations on the hijacking. Most published legal analysis agreed that or analysts rather, agreed that it would make little difference, as interpretation of the statute varies considerably from case to case and court to court. Of course, a prosecutor could argue that Cooper had forfeited immunity on any of several valid technical grounds. The question was rendered moot in November when a Portland grand jury returned an indictment against John Doe, a.k.a. Dan Cooper, for an air piracy in violation of the Hobbs Act. The indictment, in effect, formally initiated prosecution of the hijacker that can be continued should he be apprehended at any time in the future. Now, in 1978, a placard containing instructions for lowering the aft air stair doors of a Boeing 727, later verified to be from the hijacker airliner, was found by a deer hunter near a lodging road about 13 miles east of the Castle Rock, Washington area, well north of Lake Marin, but within the basic flight path of Northwest 305.
In February 1980, an 8-year-old boy named Brian Ingram, vacationing with his family on the Columbia River about 9 miles downstream from Vancouver, Washington, and 20 miles southwest of Ariel, uncovered 3 packets of ransom cash, significantly distinguished but still bundled in rubber bands, as he raked the sand on the riverbank to compile and build a campfire. FBI technicians confirmed that the money was indeed a portion of the ransom, 2 packets of $100 bills each and a 3rd packet of $90, all arranged in the same order when given to Cooper. The discovery launched multiple new rounds of conjecture and ultimately raised many more questions than it answered. Initial statements by investigators and scientific consultants were founded on the assumption that the bundle bills washed freely into the Columbia River from one of its many connecting tributaries. An Army Corps engineer hydrologist noted that the bills had disintegrated in a rounded fashion and were matted together, indicating that they had been deposited by the river as opposed to having been deliberately buried. If so, it confirmed that Cooper had not landed near Lake Merlin nor in any other part of the Lewis River, which feeds into the Columbia well downstream from the discovery site. And it has lent credence to supplemental speculation, placing the drop zone near Washington River, which merges with the Columbia upstream from the discovery site.
But the free-floating hypothesis presented its own difficulties. It did not explain the 10 bills missing from one packet, nor was there a logical reason that the 3 packets would have remained together after separating from the rest of the money. Physical evidence was incompatible with geologic evidence. Himmelsbach observed that bundles floating downstream would have had to wash up on the bank within a couple of years of the hijacking. That would be before November 1973. Otherwise, the rubber bands would have long since deteriorated. Geologic evidence suggested, however, that the bills arrived at the area of their discovery, a beachfront known as Pina Bar, well after 1974, the year of a Corps of Engineers dredging operation on that stretch of the river. Geologist Leonard Palmer of Portland State University found 2 distinct layers of sand and sediment between the clay deposited on the riverbank by the dredge and the sand layer in which the bills were buried, indicating that the bills arrived long after dredging had been completed.
Multiple alternate theories were advanced. Some surmised that the money had been found in a different location by someone, carried to the riverbank, and buried there. There was also the possibility that the money had been found on the riverbank earlier, perhaps before the dredging, and buried in a superficial sand layer at a later time. The sheriff of Cowlitz County proposed that Cooper accidentally dropped a few of the bundles on the air stair, which then blew off the aircraft after he jumped and fell into the Columbia River. One local newspaper editor theorized that Cooper, knowing he could never spend the money, dumped it in the river or buried it there, and possibly elsewhere, himself. No hypothesis offered to date satisfactorily explains all of the existing evidence. The means by which the money arrived on the riverbank remains unknown. In 1981, a human skull was unearthed along the same riverbank during excavations in search of additional evidence. Forensic pathologists eventually determined that it belonged to a woman, possibly of Native American ancestry. In 1986, after protracted negotiations, the recovered bills were divided equally between Ingram and Northwest Orient's insurer. The FBI retained 14 examples as evidence. Ingram sold 15 of his bills at auction in 2008 for about $37,000. To date, none of the approximately 9,700 remaining bills has turned up anywhere in the world. Their serial numbers remain available online for public search.
In 1988, a portion of a parachute was raised from the bottom of the same stretch of Columbia River, but FBI experts determined that it could not have been Cooper. In 2008, Jordan unearthed another parachute near Amboy, Washington. That's about 6 miles due south of Lake Murren, which proved to be of World War II-era military origin. The Columbia River ransom money and the air stair instruction placard remained the only bona fide physical evidence from the hijacking ever found outside of the aircraft. In late 2007, the FBI announced that a partial DNA profile had been obtained from three organic samples found on the clip-on tie left behind by the hijacker. The Bureau also made public a file of previously unreleased evidence, including Cooper's 1971 plane ticket from Portland to Seattle. The price was $18.52 plus tax, total $20 paid in cash, and disclosed that Cooper chose the older of the two primary parachutes supplied to him rather than the technically superior professional sports parachute. In addition, from the two reserve parachutes given to him, Cooper selected a dummy. Now, that's an unusable unit with an inoperative ripcord intended for classroom demonstrations, despite the fact that it had clear markings identifying it to any experienced skydiver as non-functional. He cannibalized the other functional reserve parachute, possibly using its shrouds to tie the money bag shut and to secure the bag to his body, as witnessed by McLeod. The FBI stressed that the inclusion of the dummy reserve parachute, one of four obtained in haste from a Seattle skydiving school, was accidental. They didn't mean to get it. The agency also posted previously unrelated composite sketches and fact sheets, along with a request to the general public for information which might lead to Cooper's positive identification.
Then, in March of 2009, the FBI disclosed that Tom Kay, a paleontologist from the Burke Museum of National History and Culture in Seattle, had assembled a team of citizen sleuths, as he called them, including scientific illustrator Carol Abraxas and metallurgist Alan Stone. The group, now known as the Cooper Research Team, is using technology unavailable in 1971 to reinvestigate important components of this case. Using GPS and satellite imagery, they are attempting to determine if the money found by Ingram floated freely to its discovery location over time,
or was found elsewhere and reburied. They have also reexamined the 727's flight path from Seattle to Reno to more precisely estimate Cooper's landing zone. Using electron microscopy, they examined hundreds of particles on Cooper's tie, identifying like lycopodium spores, likely from a pharmaceutical product, and fragments of bismuth and aluminum. In November of 2011, Kay announced that particles of pure titanium had also been found on the tie. He explained that titanium, which was much rarer in the 1970s than it is today, was found at the time only in metal fabrication or production facilities or at chemical companies using it combined with aluminum to store extremely corrosive substances. These findings suggested, he said, that Cooper may have been a chemist or a metallurgist or may have worked in a metal or chemical manufacturing plant.
In the years since the hijacking, the FBI has periodically made public some of its working hypotheses and tentative conclusions about the case, drawn from witness testimony and the scarce physical evidence. The official physical description remains unchanged and is considered reliable. Flight attendants Schaffner and Mucklow, who spent the most time with Cooper, were interviewed on the same night in separate cities and gave nearly identical descriptions. 5 feet 10 inches to 6 feet tall, 170 to 180 pounds, mid-40s, with close-set piercing brown eyes. Passengers and other eyewitnesses gave very similar descriptions. Agents believe that Cooper was familiar with the Seattle area and may have been an Air Force veteran based on testimony that he recognized the city of Tacoma from the air as the jet circled Puget Sound and his accurate comment to Mucklow that McCord Air Force Base was approximately 20 minutes driving time from the Seattle-Tacoma airport, a detail most civilians would not know or comment upon. His financial situation was very likely desperate. Extortionists and other criminals who steal large amounts of money nearly always do so, according to experts, because they need it urgently. Otherwise, the crime is not worth the considerable risk. A minority opinion is that Cooper was, quote, a thrill seeker who made the jump just to prove it could be done, unquote.
The agents theorized that he took his alias from a popular Belgian comic book series of the 1970s featuring the fictional hero Dan Cooper, a Royal Canadian Air Force test pilot who took part in numerous heroic adventures, including parachuting. One cover from the series reproduced on the FBI website depicts test pilot Cooper skydiving in full paratrooper regalia. Because Dan Cooper comics were never translated into English nor imported into the U.S., they speculate that he may have encountered them during a tour of duty in Europe. Tom Kay's Cooper research team has suggested the alternative possibility that Cooper was Canadian and found the comics in Canada, where they were also sold. They note his specific demand for, quote, negotiable American currency, unquote, a phrase seldom, if ever, used by American citizens. Since witnesses stated that Cooper had no distinguishing accent, Canada would be his most likely country of origin if he were not an American.
The FBI task force believes that Cooper was a careful and shrewd planner. He demanded 4 parachutes to encourage the assumption that he might compel one or more hostages to jump with him, thus ensuring he would not be deliberately supplied with sabotaged equipment. He chose a 727-100 aircraft because it was ideal for a bailout escape, due not only to its aft air stair, but also the high aftward placement of all engines, which allowed a reasonably safe jump without risk of immediate incineration by jet exhaust. It had single-point fueling capability, a recent innovation which allowed all tanks to be refueled rapidly through a single fuel port. It also had the ability, unusual for a commercial jet airliner, to remain in slow, low-altitude flight without stalling, and Cooper knew how to control its airspeed and altitude without entering the cockpit, where he could have been overpowered by the three pilots. In addition, Cooper was familiar with important details, such as the appropriate flap setting of 15 degrees, which was unique to that aircraft, and the typical refueling time. He knew that the aft air stair could be lowered during flight, a fact never disclosed to civilian flight crews, since there was no situation on a passenger flight that would make it necessary, and that its operation by a single switch in the rear of the cabin could not be overridden from the cockpit. He may even have known, particularly if he served in Vietnam or had friends who did, that the Central Intelligence Agency had been using 727s to drop agents and supplies behind enemy lines in Vietnam.
The Bureau feels strongly that he lacked crucial skydiving skills and experience. We originally thought Cooper was an experienced jumper, perhaps even a paratrooper, said Special Agent Carr, the current chief investigator. We concluded after a few years this was simply not true. No experienced parachutist would have jumped in the pitch black night in the rain with a 200 mile an hour wind in his face, wearing loafers and a trench coat. It was simply too risky. He also missed that his reserve chute was only for training and had been sewn shut, something a skilled skydiver would have checked. He also failed to bring or request a helmet, chose to jump with the older and technically inferior of the two primary parachutes supplied to him, and jumped into a minus 70 degrees wind chill. Assuming Cooper was not a paratrooper and was an Air Force veteran, Carr believes he could have been an aircraft cargo loader. Such an assignment would have given him knowledge and experience in the aviation industry, and because Air Force loaders throw cargo out of flying aircraft, they wear emergency parachutes in case they accidentally fall out. The rudimentary jump training loaders receive would have given Cooper a working knowledge of parachutes, but not necessarily sufficient knowledge to survive the jump he made. The Bureau has argued from the beginning that Cooper did not survive his jump. Diving into the wilderness without a plan, without the right equipment, in such terrible conditions, he probably never even got his chute open, said Carr. Even if he did land safely, agents contend, survival in the mountainous terrain would have been all but impossible without an accomplice at a predetermined landing point, which would have required a precisely timed jump, necessitating in turn cooperation from the flight crew. There is no evidence that Cooper had any such help from the crew, nor any clear idea where he was when he jumped in the overcast darkness.
Cooper was not the first to attempt air piracy for personal gain. 2 weeks prior, Paul Finney did it aboard an Air Canada VC-8 over Montana, but was overpowered by the crew when he put down his gun to strap on the parachute. Cooper's apparent success inspired a flurry of imitators. Most copycats struck during the year that followed, and some examples are Garrett Brock Trapnell hijacked a TWA airliner en route from Los Angeles to New York City in January 1972. He demanded $306,800 in cash, the release of Angela Davis, and an audience with President Richard Nixon. After the aircraft landed at Kennedy Airport, he was shot and wounded by FBI agents before being arrested. Richard McCoy Jr., a former Army Green Beret, hijacked the United Airlines 727-100 in April after it left Denver, Colorado, diverted it to San Francisco, bailed out over Utah with $500,000 in ransom money. He landed safely, but he was arrested 2 days later. Frederick Hunneman used a handgun to hijack an Eastern Airlines 727 in Allentown, Pennsylvania in May 1972, demanded $303,000, and eventually parachuted into Honduras, his country of birth. A month later, with the FBI in pursuit and a $25,000 bounty on his head, he surrendered to the U.S. Embassy in Tegucigalpa, that is the capital of Honduras. Rob Dolan Hetty, paratrooper and Vietnam veteran, stormed a United Airlines 727 in Reno in early June, extorted $200,000, two parachutes, and jumped into darkness near Lake Washoe, about 25 miles south of Reno. Police found his car that had a United States Parachute Association bumper sticker on it, parked near the lake, and arrested him as he returned to his car the next morning. Martin McNally, he's an unemployed service station attendant, used a submachine gun in late June to commandeer an American Airlines 727 en route from St. Louis to Tulsa, then diverted it eastward to Indiana and bailed out $500,000 in ransom with him. McNally lost that ransom money as he exited the aircraft, but landed safely near Peru, Indiana, and was apprehended a few days later in a Detroit suburb.
All in all, a total of 15 hijackings similar to Cooper's, all unsuccessful, were attempted in 1972. And with the advent of universal luggage searches in 1973, the general incidence of hijacking drops precipitously. There was no further notable Cooper imitations until July 11th of 1980, when a Glenn K. Tripp seized Northwest Flight 608 at Seattle-Tacoma, demanding $600,000, $100,000 by an independent account, two parachutes, and the assassination of his boss. After a 10-hour standoff, he was apprehended. But on January 21st of 1983, while still on probation, he'd made another similar attempt on the same Northwest flight and demanded it to be flown to Afghanistan. When the plane landed in Portland, he was shot and killed by FBI agents.
The Yale Playhouse Performers, the cast for our program tonight, which is 11-2017, the show, the announcer, Bill Joseph, Captain Williams. Did you want to continue?
Yeah, let's do it. Everybody gets a yeah.
Yeah, there
go,
you go.
Ahead,
yeah.
Go ahead, Chuck, read off our cast, please.
Captain William Scott is Chuck Albright. D.B. Cooper is Jim Holder. First Officer William Radisac is Don Gagon. Second Officer H.E. Anderson is Ken Anderson. I'm sorry, Allen. Flight attendant is Linda Fuller. Flight attendant is Dorothy Gallen. And ticket counter is Elizabeth Mattel. I guess I really murdered some of your names. I'm sorry. Gate agent, Elizabeth Maltu. PDX Tower is George Jin. Seattle Approach Control is George Jin. Station Ops is Jim Hart, which was not here. And our loved producer stepped in. Epilogue was with George Jin and Kathleen Pruitt and Kathleen DeFlund, Darren Mills, and others.
Thanks so much,
Dorothy.
Guys. Yeah, we have more problems with names than we do reading script. But that was our show tonight, presenting D.B. Cooper. Of course, we're I don't know whether we call it celebrating, but 46 years ago, November the 24th, this event took place. And it is in the news today, Lots of things have happened since then. The investigations that you heard tonight have been ongoing. Finally, the FBI has just given up. It's interest in continuing. But here just lately, the FBI released a letter that was written by D.B. Cooper. Hold on just a second. My assistant producer is trying to show me something here. I don't know exactly what it is.
Can you read it?
But I'll read it in just a minute. I think we've already talked about that.
It's an update.
Yeah, we have a – she's telling me about an update, which we do have that update information. And we'll continue on. Dorothy, I think you've got some information recently of October 2017. Dorothy, tell us about that.
D.B. Cooper mystery is new evidence uncovered in search presented to the FBI, and that was by Fox News. D.B. Cooper mystery solved? Physical evidence that may be connected to the unsolved 1971 D.B. Cooper hijacking case is now in the hands of the FBI agents in California. The evidence, a frayed 18-inch long nylon strap that may have come from the parachute D.B. Cooper used when he escaped from the plane with $200,000, was found in a mound of dirt in the deep Pacific Northwest mountains nearly 2 weeks ago. It was turned in Friday to the FBI's Ventura County office by acclaimed D.B. Cooper sleuth, Tom Colbert, a Los Angeles TV and film producer. Well, after 6 years of gathering information with a 40-member cold case team, I'm ecstatic that they are considering this, Colbert said, and he told Fox News during an interview Sunday referring to the FBI. Colbert is hoping the discovery of the nylon strap will reignite interest in the case within the FBI. Image shows shots of the nylon strap found in a mound of dirt with a photo of a Navy backpack, ND-8 they call it, like the one D.B. Cooper jumped with. Tom Colbert noted a similar strap can be seen in the middle of the ND-8. The FBI announced last year that it would no longer actively investigate the D.B. Cooper case to focus on other investigative priorities. The FBI interviewed hundreds of people, tracked down leads around the country, and considered 800 suspects during its 45-year probe.
Now, the FBI confirmed meeting with Colbert. Quote, any evidence brought to the FBI will be evaluated for its value, end quote. FBI Los Angeles office spokeswoman Laura E. Miller said in an email Sunday to Fox News, quote, this case falls under the purview of FBI Seattle, so my understanding is that it will be forwarded there. Aiden S. Dietrich Williams in the FBI Seattle's office told Fox News on Sunday that the FBI doesn't typically confirm or deny the routine activities we perform in the course of our investigation work to include meetings or receiving tips. She added, however, I can assure you that the FBI Seattle field office would review any physical items possibly related to the parachute or the money taken by the Norjak hijacker. Based on that review, the FBI will take any appropriate action. Former FBI Supervisor Hadlin McCain studied the nylon strap after it was found by former Vietnam Marine Jim Irwin, Tim Colbert. In 1971, a man calling himself Dan Cooper, wearing a black tie and a suit, boarded a Seattle Boeing 727 in Oregon, told a flight attendant he had a bomb in a briefcase, gave her a note demanding ransom. And after the plane landed, he released the 36 passengers in exchange for $200,000 in ransom money and parachutes. The ransom was paid in $20 bills. The hijacker then ordered the plane to fly to Mexico, but near the Washington-Oregon border, he jumped and was never seen or heard from again. 9 years later, a little boy found a rotting package full of $20 bills near the Columbia River. The $5,800 matched the ransom money serial numbers.
The FBI has never found or ruled out the possibility that the hijacker was killed in the jump, which took place in a rainstorm at night in rough wooded terrain. The hijacker's clothing and footwear were also unsuitable for a rough landing. Over the years, the most lasting image of D.B. Cooper, who became somewhat of a legend, may be the two sketches the FBI released of the suspect. Tom Colbert, walking into FBI Ventura County office Friday with potential new evidence in the D.B. Cooper case, he said his team, led by an ex-FBI agent, found the nylon strap while digging in a spot right where a credible source claimed the chute and remaining money are buried. Colbert said his team compared the nylon strap to a parachute like the one the skyjumper used. One of my former law enforcement officers that studied the sample said the stitching pattern appears to match, he said. After closing the case, the FBI issued an advisory that should specific physical evidence emerge related specifically to the parachutes or the money taken by the hijacker, individuals with those materials should contact their local FBI field office. Colbert said that is why he went to the Ventura County FBI office and met with an agent there. We sat down with him and went over the details of the chain of custody from the dig to me. He said, Colbert, who maintains a website, dbcooper.com, and his team of investigators believe D.B. Cooper is Robert Rackstraw, a 73-year-old Army veteran from San Diego with a prior criminal record. Investigators questioned Rackstraw about the D.B. Cooper case in 1978 and eliminated him as a suspect. Rackstraw has repeatedly denied any involvement in the caper. Colbert said that during the meeting with the FBI, he also gave the agent information about two men in their 80s who he believes may have knowledge of the skyjacking. He said he also told the agent where the nylon strap was found. He described the site as a lumber farm, but declined to be more specific. He said he told the agent, the site is yours. Well, that's Neil, the end of the material we've got to present tonight, and we'd like to talk to what your thoughts are about D.B. Cooper, the upcoming anniversary, November 24th, and let's hear your thoughts before we finish with a breaking news item we have. Yes.
Neil, this is Chuck. I would like to address the audience, since I'm kind of like the resident expert on something that's going to be attached to airplanes. I was told one time that I had a kit, a little box kit, and I was told to go out to a 727 to the aft stair area, and I was to open the kit up and follow the instructions. And it's what it's called, a hijack vane kit. And most planes that have aft air stairs, mainly the 727s, have this vane kit that's on a little spring, and as the plane goes faster, it pushes the vane so it blocks the stairs that can't be, even if you release the button inside or the handle, you cannot lower the aft stairs on a 727 anymore. So that's a little tidbit maybe most people don't know.
You know, Jim, I've heard it was called a D.B. Cooper's. Go ahead, Jim Holder.
Yes, my memory is exactly what he said. That's true. And Easton was the first one to do it, and they got the copyright or whatever you get on that. And other airlines, this is just what I remember. It may or may not be true. And other airlines had to pay Easton if they wanted to install that on their 727. And my memory of it was that Delta flew around for years with that out, not having that because they didn't want to pay Eastern the copyright use for it. May be true, may not be true, but it was definitely on the 727s at Eastern. I saw it many times.
Yeah, I was one of the first ones to put it on the airplane because I didn't know what it was when they gave it to me. We
but
had
it must
to have
worked pretty good.
Yeah, it does, and it's very simple. It's just a vane with a spring mechanism that as the airflow pushes against the vane on one side, it pushes a bar across the edge of the airplane and the air stairs, and the mechanical advantage of the stairs is blocked out, so the stairs can't be lowered.
Go ahead, Linda.
Who the mechanic was, but I think I was flying 727 at the same time, and he was a local mechanic there in Atlanta.
Well, I was a mechanic in Miami.
Well, this guy,
and
what it was is a pretty
simple device. I got the kit, one of the first kits that they were put on. I didn't know what it was until they explained it to me.
Uh-huh. It's a little flying wing, and it was attached to a cylindrical shaft that went in, and it put a mechanical lock inside where it could not be open, and the door couldn't be open in flight, you know.
Well, that's what this vane does. It stops the door mechanism from operating.
Yeah.
But it's on the outside of the airplane.
Yeah, it's a little flying wing, out there. And, of course, it was streamlined during the flight and kept the door locked. And then when the airplane stopped, why, it fell down and would unlock the door.
Yeah.
Right. The little spring would spring it back into the what they call the null position. Or you could drop the door down.
So that happened after 1971. Is that correct, Chuck and Eston?
It happened right after the D. Cooper deal. And I guess
Jim Holder?
It wasn't to keep the door from opening, it was keep the stairs from coming down. Those are two different things.
Down.
The door opened, then you put the stairs down.
Misled you. I was talking about the stairs. We call the stairs the door.
Oh, I'm talking about the rear door. The Cooper bailed out.
Yes. Aft air stairs door.
Yeah.
The aft air stairs door.
That's what it's actually called.
The ventral step.
Yeah. Is just my imagination that I want to call it and give it a name, the D.B. Cooper switch?
I heard it called that many times.
I'm sure somebody come up with that. I didn't hear that, but sounds good to me.
Actually happened, Jim.
It was an Eastern mechanic in Atlanta. I know that for sure.
They put it on the airplane.
Yes.
Well, we had a lot of 727s. They probably had mechanics in New York, Miami, and everywhere putting those things on.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
This wasn't Miami.
In fact,
it was probably put on all our airplanes the same week.
Yeah, that's right.
One guy
in Atlanta invented it, though.
That's good. He must have presented it to Boeing and also to the FAA to have it approved.
Yep, that's right. Yep. And the whole industry adopted it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they had to pay Houston for it, as I recall. They had a copyright on it, or whatever they call it.
Yeah, I didn't
and
hear
the word was that Delta didn't want to do it.
The only reason they have to pay Eastern is because I did something for Eastern, too. Is that he used Eastern's equipment. Maybe he used their people in their sheet metal place, or they talked to Eastern engineers. I designed a tool for the RB211 engine, and we had it produced and everything else. And after Eastern was closed in 89, when I left, some guy called me from England because it was on RB211 engines, and wanted to know if I wanted to sell my tool, the tool that I designed. And I said, well, it doesn't belong to me. You were right. Eastern was selling that tool to all the other airlines that had RB211 engines.
Oh.
What's that?
Are they still using that tool now?
Yes. To my knowledge, they are. Unless they come up with something newer or better. It's to remove
the
inner telling.
Yeah. Okay, Chuck. I don't think we're flying too many 727s anymore. I think they've all been turned over to the Middle East.
Oh, that was 1011, by the way. That tool.
Oh, the 1011. Okay. The one question here: the DC-9, which had an aft air stair, also. What was the procedure there? Essen, you probably flew the DC-9, or Jim. I never did.
I didn't either.
I didn't put any vanes on a DC-9.
DC-9. I think Essen.
I never heard about it on the DC-9.
Okay. Well,
I know what you're talking about.
You know, we had. Go ahead, Eston.
You know, on the DC-9, it was a lot different. You know, when they used that door, the whole plastic afterbody came off the airplane first, and then the stair came down. You know.
Okay.
That's true.
Okay. Yeah.
You had to go through the bulkhead to get to it.
Yeah.
In fact. A little story, I landed in Montgomery one morning as a ferry flight. I ferried it down from Atlanta to Montgomery. And on landing, and it was a very good landing, but that tail cone fell off on the runway after I landed. And I made the 180 turn coming back, and the tire says, "Hey, Eastern, look out the front. You just lost your A and two letters after that." And there
you lost
the wind
tail, huh?
On it around this big piece of fiberglass.
Good. I like that.
Well, you know, this is a very interesting information that we had tonight, and I appreciate all of our talented cast that performed tonight's show. And we did this back 2013, the year 2013. And 4 years later, we're doing it again, and not much difference, except we do have some additional information. And this was as recent as yesterday. Newly released FBI documents pertaining to the D.B. Cooper hijacking case include a letter that may only deepen the mystery surrounding the notorious unsolved crime, which marks its 46th anniversary this week. Quote, "I knew from the start that I wouldn't be caught," says the undated typewritten letter from a person claiming to be the man who said he had a bomb and commandeered a Northwest Airlines flight from Portland to Seattle on November 24, 1971. He goes on to say, "I didn't rob Northwest Orient because I thought it would be romantic, heroic, or any of the other euphemisms that seem to attach themselves to situations of high risk," he said. "I'm no modern-day Robin Hood. Unfortunately, I do have only 14 months to live." The carbon copy letter was turned over to the FBI 3 weeks after the hijacking by the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Seattle Times, which were each mailed a copy and published stories about its contents. The letter was in an envelope with a greater Seattle area postmark. Last month, the FBI released a copy of the letter that was sent to the Post in response to a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit brought by acclaimed D.B. Cooper sleuth Tom Colbert, a Los Angeles TV and film producer. He believes the letter is real. "We have no doubt it's from Cooper, and the reason is that he cites He left no fingerprints on the plane. He said the reason that's critical is because it's absolutely true. There were no prints found in the back of the plane, Colbert said. They found 11 partial prints, that's all. Sides, fingers, tips, and palm, but no prints of value were found. The person also wrote that he was not holed up in some obscure backwoods town and was not a psychopathic killer. As a matter of fact, he says, I've never even received a speeding ticket. FBI agents in the field apprised FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover of their investigation into the letter. According to other documents, the FBI turned over to Colbert along with the letter. Efforts were made by Washington Field Office to preserve the letter and envelope for latent fingerprints. Read one of the documents, an FBI memo. However, both were handled by an unknown number of individuals at the Washington Post prior to be obtained by WFO. As a matter of fact, I've never even received a speeding ticket, was one of the comments written in that letter by supposedly D.B. Cooper. So the mystery goes on. And it's considered to be one of the great aviation mysteries in American history. Any last comments about our program tonight before we say a few things from Dorothy about what's coming up, Dorothy?
Okay, we have the next show that we're having November 27th. It's Eastern's Love of the Lockheed L-1011 TriStar, following which will be December 4th. We're going to have Remembering That December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. We'll have on December 11th, Eastern and Air Force One. And following for the December 18th show will be those crazy airport identifiers. There will be no show for December 25th, which is Christmas. And by the way, we want to wish everyone tonight a happy Thanksgiving, and we hope all you folks do well. I just have a few announcements to make. We had an email today of a change of address for his email, so I wanted to remind everyone that if you do change your email address, to be sure to notify us at host@ealradioshow.com. I also wanted to mention that our sponsor, REPA, has up on their website that the incoming REPA president, Bud Robbins, plans the 2018 REPA convention in Charleston, South Carolina, that the plans have been finalized. The 48th annual REPA convention will be held at the Francis Marion Hotel in downtown Charleston, South Carolina, and it will be September 4th to departing on September 7th. Now you can go to their website, repaonline.com/REPA news, and get the details. I also wanted to mention that the Silver Liners have their convention planned at the Wyndham Grand in Jupiter, Florida at Harborside, and theirs is going to be May 15th to May 18th. I wanted to remind everyone of Neil's books, The Wings of Many, is for sale as a nice selection of books authored by our hosts as well. And they would make great holiday gifts, and they're available in the More tab book reviews. You'll find the hyperlinks to take you either to the author's website or to Amazon for purchase. I want to mention also that there's several new comments that are on the website under the testimonials and comments on different interviews that we have for the shows that we've done. So take a look at that and take a look at some of the videos that we have up on the video under More. That's it. Back to you, Neil.
Okay. My assistant producer, Emery Martinelli, just dug up some facts about what $200,000 in 1971 would buy today. it would buy 1,213,226 worth of stuff. So $200,000 that D.B. Cooper got, I guess he got most of it. That's a lot of money back in those days. It represents today, calculating with inflation and the cost of living and so forth adjustments. There's an application, believe it or not, on the computer that you can take any year, put a figure in, and find out what it is presently, present value of that money. So the annual rate was at 4% is what the calculator figures. Now, two things. At the end of this show, I'm going to play a ballad of D.B. Cooper, believe it or not. There are songs that were written about D.B. Cooper. There were movies that were made and also books that were written, of course, about D.B. Cooper. But at the end of our sign-off music, I'll be playing, if you've never heard this, you ought to listen to it, The Ballad of D.B. Cooper. And also, I received today from Big John Shira. John Shira, an Eastern pilot that was a star of the 2017 REPA convention. He is a musician, a singer, and he sent me his latest CD that he just recorded, and it's great. So, John Shira, we might want to put him down to see if we can get some of his music at one of our shows next year, Dorothy. And
okay,
if you want to go there before, he's got a website that you might want to put down and see what he has there. It's www.wonderofitall.org. wonderofitall.org. So you can spell that out. And go to his website, see Big John Shira, wonderful voice, very talented, and great songs on the CD, which I listened to before airtime tonight. So thank you, John, if you're listening, and we hope to have you on our show 2017. That's all I have for tonight, and let's get the airplane on the ground, and we'll wrap it up.
Landing, Captain Steve. Be sure to tune in again next Monday at 7 p.m. when Eastern Flight 342 will be taxiing from the gate with another great adventure. We are now what happened to B.D. Cooper. That's our show for tonight, folks. We'd like to thank all the participants on tonight's broadcast, and with this, take a line from Garrison Keillor's Lake Wanaganabe. They are all the women are unequal. All the men are good looking. All the children and grandchildren are above average. And until then, we say all good night, family.
Good night, Eastern.
We love you,
Eastern. Love you, Eastern.
We love you.
Stay tuned for the music.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye.
Good night. Good night, Ken.
Good night, Dorothy. Thank you, love. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Good night, all.
Good night, Chuck.
And now, till we meet again, adios, au revoir.
is WDBC News in Seattle. We have just received word that Flight 305 from Portland to Seattle has been hijacked. This is a developing story that we will continue to watch closely.
Cocktail past the young stewardess alone. The sensitive briefcase beside me is full of dynamite, and I could better blow up this here flight. The man was D.B. Cooper. This was his demand. Spare Flight 305 and all the folks on board. For 10,000 Andy Jackson and the parachute. He even paid for his cocktail to boot. What a lovely day. Jumping from that 727.
vanish.